Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. I was talking a little bit earlier today with Tanchinda about the just very briefly we were talking a bit about the topic of sangvega, translated usually as urgency, like a sense of spiritual urgency. Sometimes you hear it as also like a world weariness, but urgency is generally the most common way that it's talked about. The word people might recognize from the morning chanting that we do in the salutation to the Triple Gem. In the beginning line there, it's kind of translated more as encouragement. Now let us chant our salutation to the Triple Gem in a passage of encouragement in the version that we have, sangvega. But actually, and I think one of the other versions from England, it's a passage to arouse urgency. And it's a really useful quality to recognize and develop in our spiritual practice. It's easy to fall into complacency. You know, many people have a lot of inspiration when they first come to the practice for various reasons, certain experiences in their life that drive them to seek a deeper understanding of the way our lives and our minds and hearts work, and how we experience life in its ups and downs, and how to do it more skillfully in a way that leads to a greater sense of inner peace. And that inspiration can be very energizing and useful, encouraging in the first years of practice. And sometimes, actually, we see ourselves really developing and developing very skillful qualities and progressing, as we might want to evaluate it in our own eyes, progressing in the practice quite strongly in the initial stages. And sometimes, for many people, maybe even most people, that starts to settle down and it becomes more of a slower process of spiritual development, and sometimes stagnation even is what it feels like. All of that's part of the normal parts of practice. And sometimes it's accompanied by this sense of complacency. You know, we get kind of comfortable in a routine in the monastery or in our household life. And even though we have a modicum of understanding and benefit from the practice, it kind of drifts into kind of an unconscious good enough. And we lose that sense of urgency to keep on moving and to keep on growing and changing and adapting. So it's really useful to bring up reflections that reinvigorate and inspire this sense of sangvega, to keep it the practice fresh and to keep our motivations clear. And sometimes even it's useful to remember why we initially wanted to take up the practice, to go back to the roots of the initial insights or inspiration that inspired us to take it up. In the chanting that we do, there's some very concrete examples of the teachings in the form of reflections that inspire this sense of urgency. The first part of that chant is more of a devotional chant to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha in recognition of all the good qualities of the Triple Gem. And then it moves into that those passages that are reflections for encouraging that sense of urgency. It's standard kinds of reflections in the Buddhist tradition. And for those of you who may not be totally familiar with all of the teachings of the Buddha, just want to preface a little bit by saying that sometimes they can sound a bit discouraging to the unfamiliar ear, because a fair amount of the reference is towards the difficulties that we experience in life, the dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness. And to people who are just new to Buddhism or have heard bits and pieces, sometimes it sounds a bit of a downer and kind of like a negative take on life, kind of a depressing. Why would anybody want to talk about suffering and unsatisfactoriness? That's so depressing. Let's talk about happy things. And that's all well and good, because we do have to learn as a skillful technique, focusing on the good and the skillful. Have something to say about that too. But it does start with a recognition of the difficulties that we experience as human beings. There is dukkha, the First Noble Truth. It doesn't mean that life is dukkha, as sometimes you see it translated. It doesn't mean it's all dukkha. But the acknowledgement and the recognition that, yeah, there is dukkha, there is unsatisfactoriness, there is difficulty in life, there is suffering, in the strong translation of the word dukkha. And we do have to acknowledge that and own up to that and know that. Otherwise, we kind of live our lives in a bit of a fog of disbelief, or just not attending to the way of the world, the realities of the world. So this recognition of dukkha is meant to open our eyes, not to depress us, but to alert us to the realities of the human condition, and to develop a way of learning to cope, of learning to deal with it, a learning of a way to accept the good parts of existence and the difficult parts of existence, both in a way that doesn't cause any additional stress or difficulty by our habitual reactions to try and always avoid the unpleasant and always seek out the pleasant. And we develop a sense of equanimity. But it starts with recognition that there is dukkha in the world. And some of these recollections are very, very useful in a specific way to establishing that sense of urgency, that we want to do something to address these issues. So in the chanting around Sangwega, it starts out with Ja tipi dukkha, jarapi dukkha, maranampi dukkang. Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, death is dukkha. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, despair are dukkha. Association with what's disliked, with what we don't like, is dukkha. Separation from what we do like is dukkha. Not attaining our wishes, not getting what we want, is dukkha. The five, what's translated as the five focuses of the grasping mind, the panchupadana khandas, more accurately translated as the five khandas, or the five aggregates affected by clinging, are dukkha. Five aggregates, of course, being material form, the body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness. So the body and the mind, when they are clung to and attached to, are a source of dissatisfaction, stress. Again, not always, but have that potential and have that capacity to be held, grasped in a certain way that leads to difficulty, to stress. So these passages, these are the iterations that the Buddha has given in part, that are meant to cause us to reflect and think and inspire and encourage us to seek an answer to the habitual responses that we've acquired in our search for happiness. All of this comes from the search of happiness, search for happiness, just in unskillful ways that we've developed through our just not knowing any better. So reflecting on the human condition is a very useful tool for inspiring urgency. Particularly, the Buddha stresses a number of the teachings around contemplation of transitoriness of the conditions of the world. The fact that we often seek very pleasurable experiences, that's what motivates us as a route for seeking happiness. But recognizing that in the world of conditions, there isn't any kind of form of very, very stable satisfaction, stable happiness. We have moments where we get what we want and we avoid what we don't like and have pleasant experiences. And we can accept them for what they are, enjoy them to some extent. But if we attach to them and depend on them, then as their natural tendency towards dissolution happens, towards change, then we experience disappointment. So we reflect on the fact that whatever arises passes away, has its time in the world, in the existence, in our existence, we experience it, and then it changes. So all the difficult things, all the hard moments that we have, all the things that we don't like have their time, pass away. All the things that we do like, that we want to indulge in or take up for ourselves in our lives, all of those have their own life. They persist for a while, and then they change. There's this constant movement of change. And at the level of feeling of experience, pleasant is morphing into unpleasant. Unpleasant is morphing into pleasant. The neutral is also there. So recognizing that and reflecting on that over and over again about the inherent instability of what we usually take refuge in. Having to bring that up over and over again is a very useful tool towards kind of shaking us out of our complacency, establishing that sense of urgency. Even to the point, and again, people who aren't so familiar with the tradition or the practices might think this is a bit morose, but the contemplations of the end of life, the contemplations of death, aging, illness, are also very motivating, instructive kinds of contemplations. And if they're done correctly, they don't lead to a sense of despair at all. In fact, they lead to a sense of almost a sense of relief and appreciation for the fact that we can acknowledge the truth, that all of us, and all of us have experienced it in our lives to some degree of illness. We all know people, if we're young ourselves, we all know people who are aging. If we're aging ourselves, we can see it happening. We know the process of the body and the mind, the mental faculties aging, growing less sharp, growing weaker, having difficulties. We can see that. And we've seen death We know that that's where this eventually will lead to, this human existence. We sometimes try and not see it. We try and push it away. But the closer we get to it, the more it becomes obvious. And if we really take that to heart, take those contemplations of old age, sickness, death to heart, it doesn't lead to despair, but it leads to relief of recognizing the truth of the way things are. In recognizing the truth, then there is freedom. Freedom from fear, freedom from anxiety, freedom from the stress that results from pretending that it's not there. And then as these conditions evolve, we accept them with grace, ease, peace of mind, because we've prepared ourselves. It's not a shock, it's not a surprise, it's to be expected. These things happen because we're human beings. And a deep level of acceptance and peace and grace can accompany these inevitable changes. So these reflections can wake us up out of our complacency, and we get stuck in a rut, stuck in a groove, in our views and our opinions, our ideas of what's right for me, what's, you know, what I need to have, what will bring me happiness in relation to the world around us, the people we're with, the conditions we find ourselves in, the health or sickness of the body, our abilities or our lack of, you know, our lack of certain abilities, our strengths, our weaknesses. When we develop a sense of clarity around those and see how our habitual reactions can lead to that sense of discontent, sense of complacency in some cases. And we say, I want to be free of that. I've done this long enough. I have the potential to see beyond that. One of the other reflections along those lines to help develop this sense of Sangvega is one that is coined in the Tibetan tradition anyway, is the precious human rebirth, the precious human life. Of course, it's very clear in the Theravada scriptures as well, in different areas. But it's that recognition of the rarity and specialness of what's called the precious human rebirth. And it's not just the human rebirth, but it's the human rebirth. To some extent, it is the human rebirth. The actual birth as a human being is a very special birth in general, very different from the animal realm, very different from some of the other realms in the Buddhist cosmology that aren't seen, the upper realms and the lower realms, different kinds of existences. The human realm, by and large, is the most advantageous for spiritual development, because there's a very strong mixture of both positive experience or pleasant experience and unpleasant experience. There's enough pleasant experience to make life bearable, make the conditions right for being able to understand and contemplate Dhamma. There's enough unpleasant experience to act as a motivation so that purely unpleasant existences, it can be just too difficult to really understand and grow from Dhamma or even be exposed to it. Purely blissful realms, sometimes that makes it very difficult as well, because there's not that strong motivation. There's such a minimal experience of dukkha that there isn't the sense of urgency arising at all. So recollecting the precious human rebirth, we have the good fortune to have the motivation and the conditions conducive for Dhamma practice. And it's not just being a human being, but it's because there's, you know, many, many human beings in the world that never even consider these things, caught in the world of delusion, and don't have a motivation or the exposure to wake up. So the human rebirth, the precious human rebirth, is also one where there's enough of the requisites to be relatively comfortable, not be living in a deprived situation, where there's a lack of food or clothing, shelter. A person has to have a certain amount of nourishment, requisites, relative level of comfort from the elements, protection from the elements, to be able to relax enough to be comfortable enough to take in the practice of Dhamma. So we're fortunate we've got those requisites right here, more than abundant in this situation here. We also have to have an intact set of sense faculties. If we didn't have good vision to read, or good hearing to hear the teachings, or the mental capacity, if our intellect was very, very weak, we wouldn't understand the teachings. So the sense faculties have to be attuned and capable of understanding, receiving the teachings. And we have to be in the presence. We have to be around people who are practicing, people who have discovered the teachings and have practiced with them and are willing to share them in various different ways. And there's many, many, many people in the world who haven't had that kind of contact with the Dhamma, with the practitioners. So all of these factors come together to make just a normal, run-of-the-mill human life into a very special opportunity. So reflecting on that, reflecting on the rarity of that, even in this world, just looking around us, and how it's very, very possible to completely miss it altogether, lifetime after lifetime. And how fortunate we are to have stumbled upon it and have the capacity to experience and reflect and be with others who are moving along the same path. Bringing that up and realizing that the shortness of human life, the window of opportunity we have where we can actually pick this up, use it, and benefit from it, it's a narrow window before the factors of old age start to affect our abilities to do that. So Asangwega, inspiring that sense to do it now. Why wait? So this contemplation, if you do it right, it uplifts us, it gives us energy, which is a very important aspect of mind training. We need to have the energy and the interest to pursue it. And that kind of naturally leads into another set of the teachings of the Buddha, that of right effort. We have this sense of urgency, inspiration, desire, healthy desire to pursue the path, and that forms the basis for us to develop the aspects of right effort. Right effort being fourfold, the effort to maintain skillful qualities that we've developed, and the effort to increase and develop skillful qualities that we haven't developed yet. The effort to reduce and abandon the unskillful qualities that we've developed, and the effort to avoid allowing to arise of unskillful qualities that haven't manifested yet. So it's a fourfold training in right effort. And the common theme among all of those is the word skillful or unskillful, kusala, akusala, wholesome, unwholesome qualities, wanting to encourage the wholesome ones, wanting to decrease the unwholesome ones or unskillful ones. And so it takes knowing what those qualities are. Essentially, there's many qualities on either side, but the qualities that we want to develop are those that lead to a sense of long-term contentment, long-term peacefulness, fewness of wishes, easy to be pleased, easily satisfied, and using that as a base to develop skillful, pleasant, peaceful, virtuous states of mind that move us in the direction towards realization of the fullness of the path. So knowing what kusala actually feels like, what wholesome qualities actually feel like, and what recognizing the ones that are still unskillful within us, the ones that we have yet to abandon, and knowing those also which aren't very strong or aren't present within us, knowing how they might arise, and working towards preventing that from happening. But most specifically, recognizing the ones that are still entangling us, obstructing us, causing us dukkha, and how to gradually abandon them, let them go, because we realize that they're not serving the purpose that we think that they should. There's some couple of useful mental qualities that we need to develop and bring into our awareness and practice with to help us recognize kusala and akusala mind states so that we can respond appropriately. And one of them is in the practice of sati sampajanya, mindfulness, clear awareness, in bringing right mindfulness up so that we're bringing these mind states, recognizing these mind states with clarity, and remembering to do that, not just drifting and going on automatic pilot, but mindfulness, the right mindfulness, the quality of really bringing up over and over again, remembering to examine the qualities of mind that we experience in the present moment, right here and now. What is the mind like? What's the quality of the mind? Is it expanded or contracted, diffuse, focused, skillful, unskillful, full of hindrances, full of virtuous, wholesome states? Just remembering, this is mindfulness, right mindfulness, remembering the quality of mind that's occurring right here and right now. But additionally, and sometimes not recognized so much in current teachings of mindfulness, mindfulness isn't just right mindfulness isn't just this kind of knowing what the state of the mind is and being absolutely neutral towards it, and just saying, well, oh yeah, there's a lot of anger there. Well, how about that? You know, or there's a lot of, you know, sensual craving there. Well, no big deal. That's just the way it is. I'll just be mindful of it, and that's the way it is. And whether I act on it or not doesn't matter. As long as I'm mindful, as long as I see it happening, doesn't matter whether I react or don't react to these various states of mind. That's sometimes the impression you get from some of the teachings. It's just this kind of totally valueless recognition of the way things are. And there's a certain amount of not wanting to be judgmental, not wanting to bring one's own prejudices into mindfulness practice so that we can clearly see what it is without bias. But also implicit in right mindfulness is the quality of sampajanya, clear awareness, alertness, that knows more than just the bare awareness of that particular state of mind. It also sees it in its value of whether it's kusala or akusala. It sees it in whether it's wholesome or unwholesome. That's a quality of sampajanya, of clear awareness, not just mindfulness, but clearly seeing it, just as it is in its wholesome nature or its unwholesome nature. And then we have if we can see that, if we're tuned into that in our mindfulness practice, then we won't fall into just mere complacency with the way things are, no matter what they are. We realize that for the sake of developing skillfulness, we have to know it as skillful or unskillful, and we have to know it so that we can abandon the unskillful and encourage the skillful mind states. That's very, very crucial. And then through another very important mental factor that we develop, yoniso manasikara, skillful or wise attention, we can direct a retraining of our mind in a way. Because all of these states of mind are patterned and conditioned over you know, many, many years, many lifetimes. The tendencies are well entrenched as we seek happiness, gratification in ways that are useful in the short term, but maybe not so useful in the long term. Very strongly engraved in our minds and our memories. And wise attention will keep us alert to the tendencies that we have, and will encourage us to retrain the mind in ways that will bring us a longer term sense of contentment, peace. So wise attention to what it is that we're doing, the ways that we encourage, the ways that we should be encouraging skillful states of mind by what we attend to and the way we attend to it, the places we put ourselves, the people we decide to be around and associate with, the lifestyles that we take up, even the views and opinions that we hold. We constantly see through sampajanya, through clear awareness, whether they're moving us into wholesome or unwholesome states of mind, and we actively use our ability to steer our attention in a skillful direction. We have the ability to retrain the mindless habits that we've gotten caught into. This is the promise of the teaching. This is the positive aspect, is we actually have the capacity to retrain the mind, to redirect our attention in skillful ways that bring us greater sense of long-term peace, contentment. We just have to remember to use it. So yoniso manasikara, skillful attention, wise attention. Kind of reminds me, I was just thinking about a training in communication techniques that the community underwent here many, many years ago in the early days. We were working as a community on developing some more skillful ways of being with each other through meeting every couple of weeks, which we still do to this day. We still meet every couple of weeks and as a resident community to kind of just be with each other in a human way to help process our lives together, develop skillful ways of being with each other. And we found that we wanted to really learn how to communicate with each other in a more skillful way, And so we invited a trainer in the nonviolent communication, NVC, process to come and spend a weekend with us and instruct us in some of these techniques. And I found it very useful. Others didn't find it quite so useful, maybe. But I think most of us found that there was some real benefit in it, and learning how to examine our motivations under what we were saying, and then also the skill and the techniques that we were using to communicate, how easy it is to slip into difficult forms of communication or unhelpful ones. You know, and there was a part of it that was maybe a bit hokey, but I have a very strong memory from they sometimes use these little puppets to help demonstrate or drive home the point of what skillful and unskillful communication is like. And they have one little hand puppet that's a jackal, and that, you know, represents the jackal as the one who is really easily moving into wrong speech, unskillful speech. And then I guess it's a rabbit. Is it a rabbit that's the other one? That's
giraffe.
Giraffe, thank you. That's more of the example of the skillful, skillful kinds of speech. And you have these little exercises where, you know, you put on the jackal puppet and go for it. And, you know, just, you know, in a dyad or a group, you know, just, well, what would it be like if you were a jackal speaking, you know, the jackal speak? And how easy it is to just kind of rip in and tear up somebody, you know, based on what you think of, okay, well, this is what it would be like if I were going to really allow myself to speak unskillfully out of anger or frustration. How quickly the words flowed out. And then when you put on the giraffe one, and you're not just, you know, saying sweet, you know, kind of simpery things. You're trying to really say something that's skillful and clear and true. And how much effort it took to kind of do that, particularly if there's a difficult encounter, difficult situation. And I just have this memory of, like, wow, it's so easy to slip into the more unskillful ones, and how much more difficult it is to be considerate and clear and skillful, how easy, you know, how much easier it is to sink, and how much more difficult it is to rise in our development of skillful habits and the abandonment of unskillful ones. And that's actually one of the teachings, I think, from the Tibetan tradition, is that, you know, rising up in the realms of existence takes a lot more effort than it does to sink down. Just like pulling a bucket out of a well takes much more effort than it does to let it drop and go to the bottom. It's a training. It's a retraining that takes effort. The word effort, energy, is very applicable. And the other kind of image that comes up for me these days too is just in the retraining of the mind is what a few of us are doing in the retraining of our bodies. And a few of us have been seeing a physical therapist, you know, a few of us who have some specific bodily issues over time have been seeing this therapist who... One of the major things he teaches is the kind of reconfiguring of our posture as a way of really treating and preventing many bodily pains that some of us are experiencing. And that he offers a number of exercises that... we're supposed to do once or twice a day. But that actually, you know, the exercises are just a very small part of the whole process of retraining the body. That actually just as much as you can remember, just walking, standing, sitting, in all of our postures, even lying down, all of the four postures, how the retraining of the posture is something that one has to do continuously, not just in brief periods of time when we're doing specific exercises, but it's a constant kind of a process of reminding, remembering, and just doing it, not practicing for just short periods of time and then the hopes that the other 99% of our waking life, everything will just fall into place, but actually doing it throughout the day, throughout all of our activities as best as we can remember. And the mind training is the same way. We can, you know, practice meditation for an hour in the morning and an hour at night, or however we do it in our daily lives, more or less. But we have to do this kind of constant retraining throughout the day, throughout our day-to-day routine. It's not just a thing to do a couple of short times a day. So the mindfulness, the clear comprehension, the wise attention has to be constantly put into practice, constantly put into motion to really, really make the big changes that we want. All of this is part of right effort and the training of our hearts. But the more we do it, the more we experience the benefits, the more we see the results, and the more we develop faith and confidence in the practice. We see, you know, gradually, little bit by little bit over time, how this renewal of the sense of urgency, this remembering of the motivation of why we're doing the practice, the reflection of where we started, and, you know, remembering the reflection of the potential for decline if we don't maintain it, and the preciousness of this opportunity, remembering all of these things gives us the energy, the inspiration to keep progressing along the path. And it's really just up to us to take it as far as we want to, as far as we're inspired to. So I think I'll leave that for this evening's reflection.